Diva Top 5, a show where we count things down from number 5 all the way to number 1. And this week, war. Huh. Good God, you all. What is it good for? Well, obviously, it's good for this week's Top 5. Because someone wrote in and says, hey, I haven't listened to all of your Top 5s, but perhaps you have a Top 5 war movies you guys could discuss.
Yeah.
And so this week, Top 5 war movies. And my number 5, Good Morning Vietnam. Now, a lot of people don't remember that. Maybe because it's in the title right there, Vietnam. Right. But we were in that war. And the radio? The Air America?
No, I think it's...
No, Air America radio was America. The cocaine...
Air America was another movie. That was Mel Gibson.
Radio America.
Yeah, Radio America. Radio Free America. There you go. Armed Forces Radio. That's what it is. And this follows the tale of a real announcer on that on those airwaves during his time in Vietnam and some of the controversies he's caused. But as with most biopics, they kind of skew a little bit more to the insanity side, the crazy side. And so we get Robin Williams coming in, just going totally off the hook and doing all sorts of crazy things for about an hour and a half, causing audiences to laugh and forget about the seriousness of the war until Robin Williams ventures out and actually sees the war for himself. And it brings the whole tone of the movie down just a little bit and makes us all really consider about what is going on in Vietnam at a time where the Vietnam War was probably over, 10 years, 11 years? I think this movie came out in 88, 89.
I want to say it was officially over in 75.
But. Yeah, so this had been, okay, then like 12, 13 years. So, Good Morning Vietnam. My number 5 war movie. Not a lot of bullets flying or people saying, do you hear me, son? And yes, sir, yes, sir. But that's my number 5.
The real Adrian Cronauer actually said that once he saw that movie, he realized he would have been... completely court-martialed and possibly shot for some of the things that movie did.
Yeah.
He's like, there is no way I would have gotten away with a third of what they actually claimed that I did in that movie.
Right, right. But I'm sure Good Morning Vietnam spawning a whole generation of people who wanted to become radio announcers.
Yeah, that's why when Stephen and I went to college, everybody was pretending to be Adrian Cronauer. And everybody thought I was original because I was pretending to be George Carlin from 1973. See, steal from old things and people don't know.
Okay, Matthew, speaking of old things, what do you got on your number 5?
Are you calling me old?
No. I'm sure your movie list is old.
My number 5, I actually realized when I was putting the list together that I had three movies, I had three different wars. And then I said to myself, well, there are a lot of wars, you know, if we're even just looking at just the 20th century. So I'm like, what about movies specifically from a particular war, which at the time I had not looked at? And then, of course, Sarah is just like, hey, it's this movie and you have to. And I'm like, yeah, I have to. My number 5 is set during World War I. It is the story of a desperate struggle to try and stop a secret weapon that's being used by basically the Kaiser's Germany, and stopping it is this ragtag bunch of misfits. There's an American soldier, and there's a Native American, and there's a Frenchman, and there's an immortal Amazon from the island of Themyscira, Princess Diana, also known as Wonder Woman. My number 5, Wonder Woman. And you say to me, how is that a war movie, Matthew? You're breaking the rules. And I say to you, it is a movie wherein it is set during a war, where the main character's entire raison d'etre, if you will, which is very French, is to stop the literal embodiment of war from continuing to rage across the planet. And it has that beautiful sequence set in the no man's land that's actually a battlefield sequence where you see guys with guns shooting and shooting and shooting and Wonder Woman going out with her lasso and her bracelets and being super awesome. And I said to myself, Steven's going to be mad at me because I think he's going to think this is a cheat.
This is the thing. When it comes to war movies, there's going to be a lot of people going, we didn't put this on your list. You didn't put this on. Calm down. Everybody just calm down because you know what? War movies, if you go and look at the long list of war movies, there are movies on there like Braveheart. I don't know if that's on anybody's list. That's a war movie. Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. War movie. And there's a lot of things that happen during a war or that tangentially affect what's going on in the war. And so I would say that, yes, Wonder Woman is definitely a war movie.
Cool.
I mean, it definitely has war as part of the setting.
Yeah. If a war is part of the setting, then I say yes. Rodrigo?
I say play on.
What do you have for your number five?
My number five is a movie that I saw in college, and I didn't I kind of expected to hate it, but instead I kind of liked it. And that movie is Three Kings.
Oh, yeah. That almost made my list.
Three Kings stars George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube. And it's about the end of the Gulf War. And if I recall, it's about these guys who hear that basically some of Saddam Hussein's treasure is out there, like hidden, and they go out and get it. And a lot of misfortune follows them as they kind of try to do stuff because they're greedy. It is very stylishly shot. It came out in 1999, the year of James movies. But because movies because movies were changed so hard that year, nobody remembers Three Kings. I feel that if this movie had come out in like 98 or like 2000, it would have probably made a bigger splash. But with, you know, Titanic and The Matrix like running around the special effects department, that scene where you see somebody like a rapid version of what happens to someone when they get shot, and like the necrosis that follows, as like people were like, yeah, that's cool, but you know, nobody's doing air kung fu on an iceberg. My number five, a forgotten gem that you know, side note, I have not seen in a long time. So I wouldn't be surprised to like sit down and be like, oh, this movie's so racist. You know, it's like, I was like 19 when I saw this. But yeah, Three Kings.
I've been meaning to sit down and rewatch that again.
Me too. I've been wanting to rewatch this movie for about 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about probably been that long for me. Speaking of rare gems. Oh, if you thought Wonder Woman was controversial.
Oh, here comes.
Wait until you get to mine. Now, this is a John Huston movie. Many people forget that this is a John Huston movie and has some top actors in it, such as Michael Caine, Max von Sydow, and Sylvester Stallone, and Pele.
Uh-oh.
I am talking about a movie called Escape to Victory that came out in 1981.
Wow.
This movie is about a bunch of POWs who, instead of trying to escape, which they do, they try to escape their prisoner of war camp. They are challenged by the Germans to play a game of soccer.
Football, you mean?
Yes. And so the big thing is, okay, we've got to train these people to become semi-decent soccer players.
Oh, wow.
Including American Sylvester Stallone, who ends up being the goalie in this movie. And at the same time, they're also trying to help a bunch of Jewish prisoners of war escape because at one point, if I remember the story, and again, this is another one that I haven't seen in about 20 years, they are trying to figure out a way to escape. But they say, hey, we don't have enough players. And if you want us to be on par with the German players, we need these other players to come and join us. And we know that they are prisoners of war somewhere. And the Germans are like, oh, these are all Jewish prisoners. We cannot allow that. And eventually they do. And of course, they're emaciated and they can't play. And so that makes it even more of a plot point for them to not only get these 10 Jewish prisoners of war prisoners out, but also escape themselves. And so the whole third act is them trying to escape, or this secret plan to get out of the soccer stadium and escape out into the world. And the big question you have to ask yourself is, do they stick around and finish the game, or do they escape to fight another day?
Yeah.
It is Escape to Victory. Here in the United States, it's just listed as Victory 1981. This is at a time when Pele was a big deal because he could do the bicycle kick. Now everybody seems like even my kid can do a bicycle kick. At the time, you know, Pele was this big international soccer superstar, football soccer star. And it's just a crazy movie set in World War II.
Yeah, this is like one of the first things I saw him in that wasn't Rocky.
Yeah.
Oh, it was weird.
It's a very different movie. If you get a chance to see it, just remember it's directed by John Huston. It's got Michael Caine, Max von Sydow, Pele.
Michael Caine.
And it's got a bunch of professional footballers, including Bobby Moore in there. So go check it out. That is my number four. Matthew, what is your number four?
You say Michael Caine, and I just think, what do you bloody mean, Michael Caine?
Well, no, my Michael number four Caine.
Is not Michael Caine. And if you're actually British, I'd like to apologize for talking like that. But nonetheless, my number four takes place in World War II, because I said to myself, hey, I really do have this, you know, this whole weird kind of accidental theming going. So I was going to stick with it. This is actually the second film that joined my list, because when I saw, as always, Steven sends us an email and says, here's a topic for top five. And I'm like, great. I saw that email from Steven, and I looked at it like 48 hours later and went, oh, that didn't say what I thought it said. So my number four, set in World War II, it is a fascinating movie, and it is one of those films that everybody, even if you hate it, they're like, well, I know that the people who love it for a reason, and I appreciate it. You spend a lot of time saying to someone, this is why, even though the movie is wonderful, I don't like Casablanca. And that's the point where I stop listening to you, because this movie is really, really fascinating, really gorgeous, really well put together. And for a movie that's now, I think, 80 years old, 1942, is that right? 41? It still holds together, and it still feels like it's not slow or strange or alien to a modern viewing audience. And it has such emotion in it. Of course, there's that notorious scene where you see people singing the Marseillaise in tears and pride, and you realize that these people are actually currently being held away from the home that they love so much by the actual Second World War. And of course, it has that great ending where Rick Blaine, who is trying so hard to be completely antisocial and alien, finally makes maybe the first good decision of his entire life and tells her to go back to the cardboard plane where the little people are walking around because they couldn't afford a real plane. It's a beautiful shot. You can't even tell unless you look really hard and have an HD television. Did I tell you I got an HD television? Okay.
Ooh,
I know. It's like, ooh, I'm firmly in the year 2012. But it is the best of the Humphrey Bogart movies, as far as I'm concerned. It is just beautiful. It has Ingrid Bergman, who is likewise just beautiful. And while it takes place in and around, and of course is completely inextricably tied to World War II, and thus I feel is a war movie, it isn't necessarily about the people fighting in the trenches. It's about the effect that it has on the people in and around who aren't in the trenches, the people who live in the countries and live in, you know, in Europe during the beginning of the Second World War.
And so, most importantly, it's about someone who is, you know, fighting against the Nazis, who the Nazis want to capture, trying to escape and get out of the country to England, which is the key focal point of this whole movie.
Sure. And it has like a dozen iconic, beautiful moments. I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in this establishment. And the whole bit about the letters of transit. What's a letters of transit? I don't even know what a letter of transit is. And of course, that gorgeous ending and that ending monologue. And then Rick walking away with the whole, you know, what is it? The beginning of a beautiful friendship line. It's a great movie. I think we saw it for Zach on Film, didn't we?
Yeah, we've seen that.
Yeah, it's a good movie. If you haven't, go back and listen to the Zach on Film episode about it, because that's a fresher take from me and I think from everyone on the show. But yes, Casablanca. My number four war movie. It's a beautiful film. Go watch it right now.
Rodrigo, what do you have for your number four?
For my number four, I also have a black and white movie. And it is, in fact, also a very influential piece of cinema. I think in a lot of ways, Casablanca doesn't seem that old because it changed the way that film was made. You know, it's been so influential that we're kind of still doing Casablanca. And one thing that we're definitely still doing over and over again is my number four, Seven Samurai.
Ooh.
Which is a movie in which a bunch of peasants have to go out and employ some ronin, basically some samurai that don't have any masters, to defend their village, and they can barely pay them. But slowly the samurai come together and help the village. And essentially it's a movie that is punctuated by a handful of sort of tactical battles. And you see how the characters begin to bond with each other, how characters that you thought were one way slowly reveal themselves to be more vulnerable than they came across, or maybe more interesting than they originally presented themselves. You know, again, we've seen this 1,000 times. This movie is A Magnificent Seven. This movie is A Bug's Life. There are lots of versions of this movie, but Seven Samurai has kind of a lot of war movies. It's like a lot of war movies take place not in the core of that war, but in the peripheries, like Casablanca, like Three Kings. It's sort of what happens after that fighting, right? So it's like Seven Samurai presents a period in Japan where a lot of those big armies have fallen and can't subsist anymore, so they become bandits. And so it kind of becomes this is like, what is a war when there is no like kind of center to it? It's just everybody's just fighting to survive. And Seven Samurai kind of is a great story that exists in that weird war limbo.
Very cool. Very, very cool. Let's see. We are landing at number three already on our list. Wow. This one directed by David Lean. My number three. It is definitely set in World War II. This movie came out in 1957. The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh.
Yeah, based on the book. And this is the one, again, about POWs who are forced by the Japanese to build a bridge so that they can get supplies from one place to another, also a bunch of dignitaries. And the Allies find out about this, and they set up a plan to blow up the bridge. And this is a really interesting movie that looks at how people can be corrupted, co-opted, brainwashed, fall into a belief system that lets them believe that, hey, we're building this bridge so it will stand 100 years without really realizing that we are building this bridge to allow the enemy to transport their goods and people from one place to another, which actually hurts the Allies. And that is why at the end of the movie, you see the major say, "What have I done?" Sir Alec Guinness, also in another great movie, not also on my list.
But a movie with war in it.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm wondering if anybody's going to put that on their list. But
I thought about it and I didn't.
Yeah, I thought about it too. But yeah, Alec Guinness falls on the detonator and blows up the bridge. Spoiler alert for those of you who haven't seen the movie. Also something we've reviewed on Zach on Film. But another movie that doesn't really have to deal with a lot of in the trenches, let's bomb them, let's blow them up kind of stuff, but more the human side of war. And this is just a brilliant movie. The first time I ever saw it, I was just like, wow, I didn't realize you could tell a war film that didn't have people in planes trying to drop bombs or people in trenches trying to shoot at one another, but actually looks at a more human story of how war affects people and different perspectives on war. And so that is why The Bridge on the River Kwai is my number three. Matthew, your number three, yes. Please.
My number three takes place during the Korean War, which I believe takes place from 1953 to 1957, something along those lines, or maybe 1950 to 1954. I know it's in there. The problem is that in the United States, we had a television show, mm-hmm. which was three times as long as the actual Korean War, which really throws off the time frame, especially since the show itself had a subtext where it was talking about the Korean War, but what it was really saying was about the Vietnam War, which was a much fresher conflict in our mind. That television show was inspired by my number three film, and that film is MASH.
Yep, that's on my also ran.
Yeah, MASH is interesting because MASH was a book, a film, and a television series. And none of them bear even the slightest resemblance to one another, except for some plot points and some names. But the movie version of MASH is directed by Robert Altman, and it is a real mind scrambler if you are just used to seeing, you know, the funny, wacky Alan Alda show on Friday nights. And so basically the story of MASH is the story of two surgeons, Trapper John and Hawkeye, who are, again, serving in Korea, but of course, subtextually talking about the conflict in Vietnam. And it is really amazing, even though it's kind of, in certain places, nonsensical, because Altman recut the film in a different order. So you actually see a sequence where a character leaves, and then about 10 minutes later, you see her again in the film because the sequence was taken from a different place. And of course, there's a major subplot that makes a sequence, one scene make perfect sense, but the subplot isn't actually there. So unless you know about it, it's one of those moments where you're just like, this is a really great scene, but I don't understand what they're doing. But it is really fascinating. And of course, it features Donald Sutherland in his probably most charismatic role ever. His version of Hawkeye and Alan Alda's version of Hawkeye are probably about as similar as Jerry Siegel's version of Superman and Brian Bendis's version of Superman. And I mean that in a complimentary way, because there's a real kind of loving weirdness to Hawkeye in the movie. And the whole movie of MASH really takes a satirical look at virtually everything. There's a moment which 40 years later feels like it plays really awkward. A character shows up and his code name or his nickname is Spearchucker, and he is African-American. And then they explain that this is because he's a really, really good football player. And I'm like, doesn't quite fly, still pretty racist. But then, of course, he ends up being the hero and putting people, you know, putting one over on the racist people in the next sequence. So I'm just kind of like, can I forgive this for 1970? Can I not? And you watch the film over and over and over. And really, everybody in it is terrible, but they're also very human. And of course, it has Gary Berghoff as Radar, the only character who crosses over from the film to the television show, which then makes you wonder, you know, you always hear the thing about, well, this is a character's dying dream. I feel like MASH the movie is Radar's real experience, and MASH the television show is Radar's dying dream. And I know that that's a terrible thing to say, but if you get a chance to watch MASH, and it airs every once in a while on like TBS in the middle of the night, make sure you watch it unedited. Make sure you take into account that there are going to be some really questionable sequences 50 years later. But kind of look at what they're trying to do and what they're trying to say, and the amount of just sheer bizarre entertainment and scenery chewing in this film, I think will put it over the top, and it will get past the problematic into the entertaining for you. And if it doesn't, I apologize. We'll move on. There'll be a better film down the line, I'm sure.
There you go.
Yeah.
Rodrigo, your number three, please.
My number three is also Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So a couple things on it. I think Bridge on the River Kwai works really well as a metaphor for war, especially from the Alec Guinness character's perspective, mm-hmm. where he kind of gets into winning small victories as a prisoner of war. Is like, well, I want my men to do this, and then the Japanese allow him. Is like, well, we're going to do this, and the Japanese allow it to build the bridge. And then he's like, well, we're going to continue. Basically, we're going to keep winning and winning and winning. We're going to build this bridge. It's going to be amazing, and everybody who looks at it is going to be like, man, British people are great.
Right.
And it's not until the end that he realizes that he has, you know, gone a completely wrong direction just because he got so kind of hung up on all of those, like on that small succession of victories. The other thing, of course, about Bridge on the River Kwai is that it's a great movie that has a so-so movie in the middle of it, as a character that leaves.
Yeah,
a character leaves in the first act and then has his own little war movie. And then it's like, we now return you to the actual war movie already in progress. And it fits and it makes sense. And those two characters seeing each other again at the very end is a strong moment. But also, you can take that whole part out and like it would not affect the movie. Which is bad. It means it's bad. You know, it's like, if it wouldn't change how you feel about the movie, then that could have all been done away with. But anyway, yes, Bridge on the River Kwai, definitely a very good war movie that we watched for Zach on Film, and I have since watched again, which is more than I can say for the majority of Zach on Film movies that we saw, because that's just the sort of non-movie watching supposed film student that I am.
There you go. Let's see, number two, Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine, Charles Bronson, football star Jim Brown, John Cassavetes, and a whole bunch more, and the rest.
Are here on,
They are the Dirty Dozen. Well, not all of them, but some of them.
Most of
them. This is so if people are like, I want you guys to have movies where good guys are shooting at bad guys. Okay, here's a whole movie about that, where you take 12 of the dirtiest, roughest, toughest, meanest, AWOL-iest,
criminalists,
rapists, Telly Savalists, and
the Telly Savalist.
I'm the Telly Savalist, baby.
And you tell them,
Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland, yes. And you tell them, hey, we will give you a pardon if you guys go out and blow up this this Nazi party that's going on at this castle. And then for the next 2.5 hours, you see them go through the training, you see them go through the mission, and you see most of them die by the end of the movie. In fact, you see Jim Brown take a whole bunch of grenades and just drop them down the chimney and blow up the secret bunker where the Nazis are hiding.
Danny Lopez is in that, too.
Yeah, this is a good movie. This is one of those that is a little bit fantastical. Today, this would have like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Bruce Willis, and the rest.
Jason Statham.
Yeah, this would be your
Chris Evans.
What is that line of movies where it's got all those old action stars in it?
The Expendables.
The Expendables. That's exactly what The Expendables is. It's a remake of The Dirty Dozen. And that is such a good movie. 1967 is when this came out. It also has some very problematic places. Like I said, there is a character that is a rapist that goes on a rape and killing spree at one point in the movie. And there's some other problematic things, especially as you're dealing with some of the one person of color that's in this movie. But overall, it's a very good movie to watch. And if you're looking for, I want to see good guys blown up bad guys, this is the movie on my list that is for you. The Dirty Dozen at my number two. Matthew, what do you have for number two?
You know, the thing about The Dirty Dozen that proves that
it's a Christmas
movie?
Than
real life?
Oh.
No, it's not a Christmas movie. It's actually based on real life events, loosely. But the real life group was not called The Dirty Dozen. It was called The Filthy 13.
There you go.
That is a true fact.
Not,
look
not
it up.
The Inglorious Bastards?
No, that's a made up word.
No.
That's not how you spell bastards either.
The Dirty Baker's Dozen.
Also, we prefer the term differently legitimate. Now, my number two takes place during the Vietnam War. And I have to stress that this is a really good film by an excellent filmmaker. And for me, the first half of it is an incredible film experience. And the second half is just there to fill out that half hour before you go to bed. But my number two, Full Metal Jacket, is three things. It is not just a movie about the experience of becoming a soldier, which is something that I don't know firsthand, so I don't know how accurate it is. It's not just a movie about the experiences that, you know, people have in wartime. It is the only thing I've ever liked Matthew Modine in ever. And I think that that makes a difference. It's difficult when you have an actor that you know, you just want to punch. you want to punch really hard, and you place them in the center of this engaging story directed by Stanley Kubrick, or produced by Stanley Kubrick at least. And you take this character and you put him in the center of all of the chaos that is Full Metal Jacket, and somehow the terribleness of Matthew Modine kind of becomes this warm blanket that you can retreat to when things get way too cold. And this film really does just have some terrible sequences in it. There are long stretches of this film that if I watch in the house, I get yelled at. And I don't get yelled at by one person. I get yelled at by three different people who are like, why are you watching this terrible thing? Turn it off. But the first half of the movie, it's just this incredible, engaging experience, and it takes you with Matthew Modine's character, Joker, and takes you through his experiences in boot camp. It makes Arlie Ermey a house name. It makes all of these experiences, you know, kind of not necessarily palatable, but something that you see in movies for the first time. And these are stories that people claim are based on things that actually really do happen and really did happen. And that's horrifying to me. And that's part of the reason why you watch this film. You watch the experiences of these characters kind of the same way you do any Kubrick film, which is to say, you know, they're all just going to end terribly, but you can't look away. You know it's going to be bad. And of course, it does end terribly. And as I say, the second half of this movie is a completely different film than the first half. And it's not even necessarily a bad movie. It's just one that I like a heck of a lot less than the first half. But either way, that first half is strong enough to net it the number two on my slot, Full Metal Jacket. Oh, man. I don't even know if Joker has a real name in that movie. That's how weird that film is.
Yeah. It's pretty intense.
It is.
Yeah.
Especially anything dealing with Vincent D'Onofrio.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you thought his Kingpin was scary?
Rodrigo, what is your number two?
You thought his cockroach monster was scary?
No!
No!
Nobody did!
No. It was cute. So my number two is a movie about a bunch of recruits that join the war effort because their homeland is attacked by a foreign enemy, and they all rush to sign up. And as it turns out, both the initial training and then the war itself is really not what they expected, and they are facing a dire enemy who is both more numerous and better at handling their own terrain than they are. And things go really poorly for them for the majority of this movie. I'm talking, of course, about Starship Troopers.
I knew it. So you're one sentence in, and I was like, oh, this is Starship Troopers.
This is Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
Casper Van Dien, Denise Richards, Neil Patrick Harris. I feel like this is the film that put Neil Patrick Harris back on his, like, upward path. Obviously, his breakout hit as an adult was Harold Kumar, but right. Starship Troopers kind of got him in through the front door there.
Mm-hmm.
I Starship Troopers has a lot going on. I hesitate to compare it to RoboCop, but I think there is a sense there that you're watching a movie. It's like when you're watching RoboCop, you're watching a movie about a guy who's like a cyborg and he's like dealing with that. And in this movie, you're watching a bunch of kids who join the army and they're dealing with that. And there's fighting and gunshots and monsters and robots and stuff. But in the background, there's kind of all this stuff going on and all of this like things that say is like, well, the world is kind of united under this like weirdly fascist order. That
not
is
weirdly
like
fascist, hyper, really fascist.
Yeah. Yep. Hyper capitalistic. Like it's like, oh, yeah, he's like, you know, this is available for citizens. If you'd like to know how to gain citizenship, join the army. Just like and you can get through Starship Troopers without paying attention to any of that. And you're like, oh, yeah, there's like some fighting and some boobies and then some more fighting. But I think Starship Troopers was kind of trying to get some stuff in under the radar. I don't know how well it did it I was pretty young when I first watched it, and I feel like I got those things and those references and what it was trying to do. But then again, I was also very distracted by anybody telling me Casper Van Dien is Argentinian. So,
well, you know, in the future, people are allowed to move around however they want. And so there's no such thing as a border.
I think that there's a much more sinister why Buenos Aires is entirely populated by like white English speaking people. So we'll call the fact that they cast these actors as a bold choice rather than them just casting like five up and coming sexy people.
The hotness of the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Paul Verhoeven, or however you say his name, Verhoeven.
Verhoeven.
You know, also did direct RoboCop. So when you're looking at the similarities between the fascist authoritarian state during a war time, or in the case of RoboCop, during a time where we're at war with crime. The parallels that you see between those two movies is not by accident. That's all Verhoeven and his view on fascist dictatorial states.
His look almost slapstick take on satire.
Yeah.
I didn't even look that up, which makes me a bad film student, but I recognize the theme. So that makes me a good film student. I'm glad I spent all that money at an expensive university. Look at that.
Look at Rodrigo.
Look at me.
All right. Look at the big brain on Brad.
We have made it all the way up to our number ones. When it comes to war movies, there's only one movie that immediately jumps to mind as a movie that I want to watch. If someone's like, hey, you want to watch a war movie? I'm like, okay, sure. Let's watch The Great Escape. And then people are like, that's not what I was talking about. I'm like, great. Let's watch The Great Escape. And they're like,
watch Black Hawk Down.
Yeah.
Let's watch White House Down.
Let's watch The Great Escape because it's got everything you want. In a war movie, it's got the good guys who are all been wrapped up into a POW camp, and they have to escape. That is their job as a prisoner of war during wartime. Their duty is to escape, not to just sit idly by. And there are some people that are like, maybe you should just sit back and do nothing. But then there's a whole contingent in this movie of, oh, no, we are going to not just get one or two people out. We're going to get hundreds of people out in this great escape, again, based on real events, later turned into a horrible, horrible Hogan's Heroes comedy on television. But if you're talking about major stars, if you're talking about the Ocean's 11 of war movies, this is the movie you want to see. Not Dirty Dozen. You want to see The Great Escape because it's got Steve McQueen riding motorcycles. It's got James Garner. You know, James Garner. I mean, that's like the only reason really to watch this movie. It's got Richard Attenborough. It's got James Donald, Charles Bronson again, Donald Pleasance going blind there, James Coburn. And the list goes on and on and on and on. So this is a good escape movie, filled a lot of tension. It's filled with, you know, evil bad guys. You've got good guys trying to do stuff. You've even got people who are dead set in their ways, and they believe that there's only one way to escape. And there's a lot of internal tension going on behind the scenes. But if you're looking for kind of a, I don't want to say a feel-good war movie, but if you want one that kind of has an uplifting thing at the end where, yeah, they don't all escape, but man, they sure gave it their all. The Great Escape from 1963 is definitely a movie you want to watch, and it is my favorite war movie of all time.
Did you say it has Lee Marvin and James Coburn?
It does.
Wait, no. They are the same man.
No, they're two different people.
No, they are the same man. He changes his name for tax purposes.
Movie magic.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Oh, that's eerie.
Matthew, what is your number one?
Well, again, because of the accidental theme of my list this week, each one of my movie choices takes place during a different war. And of course, this one takes place during 1984, World War III. I don't know if you're familiar with this. In the opening months of World War III, several freedom fighters, mostly teenagers, came and fought against the combined Cuban and Russian forces that had taken over the Midwest. And they also had a little bit of help from Mike Hammer. And I'm talking, of course, of 1984's Red Dawn. People talk about 1984 as a great year for great movies. And What it also was a great year for really bad movies that are somehow endearing at the same time. And Red Dawn falls right in the middle of that Venn diagram of bad movies that you somehow find really lovable. It's almost a Brat Pack film because it has Charlie Sheen, C. Thomas Howell, has Patrick Swayze in it. And they are all these teenagers who live in Nebraska. And by the way, that's not Nebraska. There are way too many mountains in the background for it to actually be Nebraska.
They flee to the mountains of Nebraska.
The mountains of Nebraska, right.
They're kind of there, but, you know, hard to find sometimes.
That's why
the bad guys can never find them.
Because they're in the mountains of Nebraska.
They're in the mountains of Nebraska, the hardest place to find on any continental map of the United States.
That is very true. But the really interesting thing about Red Dawn is how it takes some of the bits and pieces that you see in a traditional war movie. And when I say traditional, I'm talking like John Wayne and Audie Murphy and, hey, you know, everybody, come on, step together and we like Ike kind of thing. The old school war movie where everybody is just, you know, screaming for your side. And it turns it a little bit inside out, and it has all of these little teenage characters. So it's almost like 16 Candles with rifles in a way. But the thing about Red Dawn, I think, that sticks with me more than anything is the underlying narrative that throughout this whole movie, and this is very unusual for a movie made in 1984, there is literally no one who is safe. Powers Booth shows up about halfway through the movie, and he's like literally the only character in the movie who actually knows what he's doing. Powers Booth gets killed. You have a moment where Jennifer Grey, who had just come off of Ferris Bueller's Day Off and was America's sweetheart at the time, gets shot down in cold blood in the middle of a sequence. Even Patrick Swayze does not survive this film. And so as you go through this, it starts out as kind of this weird little feel-good movie, almost like a high school, you know, football plot. Yay, Rudy's going to win. But then it also has moments where people are literally shot. At one point, one of their number sneaks off into town, gets captured, has a tracker planted on him, and allows the evil forces to find the people hiding in the hills. So they go and they execute their friend. And I'm like, man, this is some really heavy stuff for what I thought was a sequel to 16 Candles, you know? And I'm not saying it's a good movie. Certainly not a good movie. A, it's one of the few movies that I could find that is about the World War III that started in 1984. And B, it's a movie that will stick with you, especially the closing narration. The bits and pieces of it that stay with you are to the point where, you know, when they made that remake with Thor and his brothers a couple of years ago, people were like, I want to love this movie as much as I used to love the old movie. And they couldn't. And people were trying to make the argument that, you know, the Red Dawn that was made in 2012 is inferior to the movie from 1984. But they couldn't make that argument because the Red Dawn from 1984 is also not a good movie. So they just sort of spun in little self-referential circles until there was blood all over the walls. And really, it's kind of a metaphor for the movie itself. And that sentence, my friends, may actually win me some sort of award for sophistry. But nonetheless, my number one movie, Red Dawn from 1984, probably, I want to say, the very first time that I recognized on screen Harry Dean Stanton. And I spent the rest of my life, and the rest of his life, may he rest in peace, every time I saw Harry Dean Stanton in a movie, I would do a little squeal and go, oh, look, it's him. So, you know, that's kind of cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Rodrigo, you are going to close out our list this week with your number one war movie.
All right. My number one war movie is probably the only movie that has any sort of protracted war sequence that I will actually willingly sit down and watch, or even put on myself. Usually, I don't tend to like war movies or movies that are actually about combat. You know, quick action sequences are fun, you know, maybe like big action set pieces are fun as long as something else is happening, but usually I'm not drawn to that stuff. However, there is one movie that does have a big old battle in it that I will watch over and over again, And that movie is The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
Man, okay.
Shield surfing.
Yep. That movie has a colossal battle in it. I mean, it is the majority of the movie in what is essentially a 3+ hour movie. The Battle of Helm's Deep just kind of keeps going and going and going, and not in a boring way, thankfully. It just kind of keeps developing, right? It's like at first the bad guys are doing this, and then they find a way in, and then the good guys find a way to rally. And meanwhile, there's sort of all these like smaller stories that are developing while this war is going on. It's a battle, like there's a secondary battle somewhere else. There's a lot going on, and it is a fantasy movie. So, you know, there's like orcs and trolls and, what do you call them? Nazguls. And, you know, all kinds of weird critters, taking part in the fighting. You know, I did say that I would watch this movie over and over again. Fortunately, though, if you want to spend the whole day watching this movie, you just kind of have to put it on twice because it is extremely long. And by now, I've seen it so many times that I just kind of like black out during parts of it. And then when I like snap back to it, I'm like, oh, we're in this part. Like I don't even remember like watching the previous stuff. But yeah, definitely for me, The Two Towers is really accomplishes something amazing, which is it has kind of these prolonged action sequences that continue to be interesting. Compare that to, say, any given Transformers movie, which is like is going to be like 70% to 90% action. And it just all kind of turns into this like mess, right? Whereas The Two Towers and really all of the Lord of the Rings trilogy does a very good job of sort of like pacing out its action sequences to have them be both long and interesting as they go.
I have been able to watch, at the time, 9 Star Trek movies in 24-hour period and never had a problem with that. But man, I cannot watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy in one sitting. It just kills me.
It's tough. It is tough.
We've kind of started a tradition in my house that on Thanksgiving we'll watch the Lord of the Rings extended edition.
Mm-hmm.
Last Thanksgiving I had to work, so my girlfriend called me at work, and a coworker was like, oh, what's going on? And I was like, oh, she's watching Lord of the Rings. And she's like, oh, she's watching it without you. And I'm like, that is still like, I have a full day scheduled, and that will still be playing when I get home. Like, I'm working. I think I was working a 10-hour shift, and I'm like, when I get home, Lord of the Rings is still going to be on.
Yep.
And probably there'll still be plenty to watch.
Yep. Yeah. You probably won't even be into the last movie by the 10 hours.
The extended editions are colossal. They are just so long.
Yep.
And it is, I mean, that is that sort of thing. It's like, it's so much movie that I couldn't actually, I think if I actually sat down to watch them, I probably couldn't actually pay attention to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Thereby missing the extra scenes or some amount of the extra scenes, and thus kind of, you know, negating any benefit to actually watching the extended editions. Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you go. Our top 5 war movies. Now, I mentioned a couple that were on my ran list. I mentioned MASH and Three Kings. Mm-hmm. I also ran list, also had Apocalypse Now on it, Empire of the Sun with Christian Bale, and Lawrence of Arabia.
Yep.
So
Lawrence of Arabia was on my list. I also had War of the Colossal Beast, Star Wars, Captain America, Civil War.
And don't forget War of the Worlds.
Yeah, World War Z.
Mm-hmm.
The War at Home. War of the Roses.
War of the Roses, yes.
With Kathleen Turner
mm-hmm.
at her very best.
Rodrigo, did you have some also-rans?
Yeah, mostly I had a few Zakon film standouts like Lawrence of Arabia. Mm-hmm. But after a while, I was like, I really need to like kind of break down what I think is a war movie and see if there's anything else that would kind of corner qualify into movies that I actually really like. Mm-hmm. And that's how Starship Troopers and Lord of the Rings crawled into the list.
Yeah, very good.
Right.
All right, listeners, here's what you need to do. Head over to majorspoilers.com, and in the comments section for this episode, we want you to share your top five war movies or your reactions to our top five list. Why? Because everybody loves a list. We'll be back next time for even more fun. And in the meantime, if you want to see this show continue and maybe even become a weekly show, head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. And pledge your support today. Every little bit helps. And if we had every single one of you listening to this show right now become a $2 or $5 a month member, we would blow through all of our goals in one day. So what are you waiting for? Patreon.com/majorspoilers. And until next time, take care, everyone. We will see you soon.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.